It's a great privilege to speak on David Livingstone, such a great character from history, church history and geographical history, and also from the history of Scotland and many African countries. It's a great privilege to do this tonight. Florence Nightingale said that David Livingstone was the greatest man of his generation. So what was it about this man that made him such an iconic figure, receiving such praise from someone as esteemed as Florence Nightingale? Well, before we come to look and see why he received such praise, I want to read a few verses from Scripture, and it won't surprise you what I'm going to read from. It was the Scripture that inspired David Livingstone in many ways and many other missionaries over the years, and it's from the Great Commission in Matthew 28. And Jesus speaking says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I am with you always to the end of the age." Well, as John has already said, David Livingstone was born in Blantyre, Scotland, March 19th, 1813, which was 200 years ago, just passed on Tuesday. David Livingstone had a very hard upbringing, and his upbringing had a lot to do with the making of the man, a lot to do with the man that he became. Blakely is Livingstone's official biographer, says this just very, very briefly. He says, "The influence of his Highland blood was apparent in many ways in David Livingstone's character, and so was his preparation for ministry." Now, the course here at the college, the IBC, the course that I studied under just a few years ago was the preparation for ministry course. But David Livingstone didn't have the luxury to study in a building such as this. He didn't have the luxury to study for a few years like I did in comfort and ease in IBC. Instead, David Livingstone's preparation for ministry, his preparation for his African expeditions, started not with comfort and ease, but in extreme discomfort and hardship. His early life was very hard indeed. Raised in tenement housing here, the housings in which Livingstone lived. Now, it doesn't look too bad. We're thinking, well, it's a very large, spacious place for anyone to live. But Livingstone lived in just one room of this tenement building. A room that was 14 feet by 10 feet. One room which housed his parents and seven children. One room, 14 by 10, seven children, two parents. Now, David's family was a very strict Presbyterian family, Church of Scotland family. His father was a Sunday school teacher and a tea salesman who gave out tracts to everyone he met on his travels. Again, Blakely notes about Livingstone's father. He says he was a Sunday school teacher, an ardent member of a missionary society, and a promoter of meetings for prayer and fellowship, before such things had ceased to be regarded as badges of fanaticism. While travelling through the neighbourhood parishes in his vocation of tea merchant, he acted also as a coal porter, distributing tracts and encouraging the reading of useful books. He took suitable opportunities when they came of him to speak to young men and others on the most important of all subjects, and not without effect. He learned Gaelic that he might be able to read the Bible to his mother, who knew the language best. He was indeed the very soul of a missionary. That's David's father. So you can see perhaps where he started to get some of his thoughts. But the Livingstone family left the Church of Scotland and joined an independent church, which is still in Blantyre, the Congregational Church in Blantyre. Jill, who is another biographer of Livingstone, one who is less inclined to be favourable to Livingstone, unlike Blakely. Blakely is a bit, can be hagiography at a time, a bit like hero worship. But Jill is not so. He is perhaps a bit harsh on Livingstone. So if you want Livingstone warts and all, this is the biography by Tim Jill. But Jill suggests that the Livingstone family came under the influence of revival-style preaching, influenced by the American revivalist Charles Finney, with David's younger brother Charles travelling to America to train under Finney. Now, Finney was a preacher, just as a bit of an excursus. Finney was a preacher in the Second Great Awakening in America. Now, not the awakening under Jonathan Edwards and George Whitfield and the Wesleys. Finney's style of revival was a bit different. Years ago, in the First Great Awakening under Jonathan Edwards and George Whitfield, people believed that revival was a sovereign work of God, that man could not induce revival. Man could not set up a tent and ask people to come, and revival would happen. That it was a sovereign work of God alone. But under the Second Great Awakening, especially under Finney's sphere of influence, thinking changed. And Finney and other men taught that revival could be worked up. That revival was merely the persuading of man to accept Christ or to make mental assent to certain facts. Finney did not believe in original sin. He certainly didn't believe in the total depravity of man. And so things changed, and people coming to the front of a meeting, as you've seen in Billy Graham Crusades, happened for the first time under Finney. People came down to the anxious bench and they were led to Christ for salvation. So it seems that the Livingston family, influenced by this sort of stuff, left the strict Presbyterian church, disillusioned by the strict predestinarianism of the Church of Scotland. And it seems they left for that reason and joined themselves to the independent, to the Congregational Church. At the age of 10, David started working 14 hours a day in the local mill as a piercer, fixing broken fibres in the mill of the cotton. So he had a very, very hard upbringing. Jill mentions piercers and what their work involved and some of the hardships that they endured. Piercers needed sharp eyes and the power of constant attention if they were to avoid frequent beatings. They also had to be unusually agile, since their work often involved climbing under the machinery or balancing over it. Piercers walked anything up to 20 miles a day in the mills, and much of this distance was covered crawling or stooping. Long hours on their feet often gave them bow legs and varicose veins. Each adult spinner had 3 piercers attending his machines, and since he was paid in proportion to what he produced, it was in his interest to force the children on. Often toward evening, they started to fall asleep on their feet, but a beating with a leather strap or a dousing with a bucket of water generally renewed their energies. Evidence given to contemporary government commissions inquiring into factory conditions confirmed that many of these children ended up with limbs deformed and growth stunted. The mills were steam heated to temperatures of between 80 and 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So the young Livingston, 10 years old, my youngest girl Hannah is 10 years old. And to think of her going in to this factory to work 14 hours a day in these conditions is actually hard to comprehend. It's hard to even get your mind around it. 20 miles in one shift on their hands and knees. A typical day for the young Livingston was rising at 5 in the morning to be at the mill for 6. And working until 8 p.m. Then attending school from 8 to 10. And then home to do homework until midnight or after. Then, of course, rise again at 5 and start the day all over again, 6 days a week. This preparation for ministry tells us a lot about the young Livingston and shows us how the elder Livingston was able to accomplish the things that he did. 14 hours a day, finishing at 8 p.m, going to school for 2 hours, coming home, studying for another 2 hours or more, until, as he says in his journals, his mum came and took the books off him. That's when he went to bed, usually well after midnight. Children were made of sterner stuff back in the 19th century. And even at this early stage in life, Livingston's insatiable appetite for learning is evident. With part of his first week's wages from the mill, he purchased rudiments of Latin and taught himself Latin. What he would do is he would set the book up at the edge of the machinery, and once he had creeped down below and fixed any problems with the cotton, he would creep back out again and read the book for perhaps 30 seconds to a minute at a time, and then he would go back in and do what work he had to do. And this is how he read, and he read book after book like this. And some of the other children in the mill were so jealous of David because he could read and they couldn't, that they used to throw spools and throw things at his book to knock the book over just to get to rile his temper. Reading in the factory. And I especially appreciate this, for the first book I ever read was read in a factory. Read, like Livingston, probably 1 minute at a time between working on a machine. So reading this and learning this particularly affected me and took me back to my time working in the factories. Reading Charles Spurgeon, All of Grace, the first book I ever read in a factory. Not as harsh conditions as David, mind you. So he worked for many years as a piercer. This wasn't just happened for a week or two. For many years he worked as a piercer before being promoted to a spinner. And even when he was trained in a medical school in years to come, any time off Livingston had was spent in the mill, working to pay for his tuition at medical college. Although David was raised in a godly home, as we see from his father, he himself was not converted until he was 20 years old. In fact, in some ways, he fought against the faith of his parents. He would rather read botanical books or scientific books. And one day he received a beating from his father because he refused to read Wilberforce's Practical Christianity, calling it old, dry theology. And his dad would beat him and make him read it. But he was converted at 20 years of age. And we read from Blakely, who quotes from Livingston's own journals about his conversion. And it says this: "It was about his 20th year that the great spiritual change took place which determined the course of Livingston's future life. But before this time, he had earnest thoughts on religion. Quote, great pains, he says in his first book, had been taken by my parents to instill the doctrines of Christianity into my mind. And I had no difficulty in understanding the theory of free salvation by the atonement of our Saviour. But it was only about this time that I began to feel the necessity and value of a personal application of the provisions of that atonement to my own case." And on. "I saw the duty and the inestimable privilege of immediately to accept salvation by Christ, humbly believing that through sovereign mercy and grace I have been able to do so, and having felt in some measure its effects on my still depraved and deceitful heart. It is my desire to show my attachment to the cause of Christ, who died for me, by devoting my life to his service." And then we get this call to missions. What was it that prompted Livingston to want to be a missionary? Well, he was prompted by reading the appeal of Gutzlav to the churches of Britain and America on behalf of China. It was, he says, the claims of so many millions of his fellow creatures and the complaints of the scarcity of the want of qualified missionaries that led him to aspire to the office. So he originally wanted to go to China to be a missionary. But in 1836, Livingston enters Anderson University, Glasgow, to study medicine. Now remember Livingston's upbringing. This was absolutely remarkable that this factory boy would go to university to study medicine. David Livingston is perhaps the first ever factory boy or mill boy to attend university. That's such a remarkable young man. In fact, his biographers say that the university, they are sure, laughed at his application, seeing where he was from, seeing his address, the tenement buildings in Blantyre. David Livingston was not born with a silver spoon in his mouth by any stretch of the imagination. So he enters university, and in 1837, he makes his first contact with London Missionary Society, who he will end up going to Africa with and fall out with in later years. In 1838, he starts a probationary year at the London Missionary Society in Essex. He starts theological studies there, so he's studying to be a doctor, and he's studying theology. Livingston had planned to sail to China to become a missionary, but the Opium Wars and other political intrigue forced him to reassess. And then in January 1838, he moves to London to continue medical studies. And here he meets Robert Moffat, this man here with a cool beard. He met Robert Moffat for the first time, and he heard a speech given by Robert Moffat. Moffat was a missionary in Africa and had been in Africa for many years. And he spoke about looking out from his mission station in Kuruman and seeing the smoke of 1,000 villages where the gospel had never been preached. And he painted such a wonderful picture of all these native people who were just dying to hear the gospel, that Livingston said, Africa, that's the place for me. In 1840, he passes his exams to become a doctor, and is also ordained as a missionary that same year. And in December, sails for South Africa. 1841, he reaches Cape Town. And one of the first things Livingston notices when he arrives in Africa is how similar the Africans are to his Highland forefathers. Waters records this in this little book. He says, the strangeness, the otherness of Africa was not what had impressed itself on the mind of the young Scot when he came to the Cape in 1841. The coastal people he had met there reminded him so much of the Highlanders of his grandparents' generation. The border tensions between settled and less settled clans, the cattle lifting that was not seen as theft, yet could lead to outbreaks of fighting that transformed the landscape. So he arrives in Africa and he sees that the Africans aren't much different than the Scotch, that they fight over stealing cattle, they fight over territory, and he thinks they're much like the Highlanders of his grandparents' stock. Then in July he arrives at the mission centre in Kuruman, where Moffat had said he had seen the smoke of 1,000 villages yet to hear the gospel. Moffat wasn't there, and Livingston found that things were not exactly as he had been told. And Jael mentions this. Livingstone is a bit disillusioned when he gets to Kuruman. Livingstone had not expected Kuruman to be an aesthetic paradise, but he had expected the place where Moffat had laboured for 20 years to be large, densely populated, entirely Christian, and within the reach of other heavily populated areas. Moffat himself had spoken of the smoke rising from the fires of 1,000 villages to the north. Livingstone was horrified to find that almost all his hopes had been false, and the mental picture of the place which he had treasured for so long was a grossly distorted image. There were no 1,000 villages. There was no smoke rising up. And Kuruman was not the paradise he had been led to believe it was. So Livingstone starts out and he's very disillusioned by the missionaries he meets. And during the next couple of years, Livingstone travelled back and forward from Kuruman, attempting to set up mission stations in other locations. And he did this successfully in Mabotsa in 1843. Now, Livingstone's life in Africa is full of extraordinary stories, far too many for me to mention tonight. But none, perhaps more so, than what happened to him on the 16th of February, 1844. And for this, I'll quote Livingstone's journal, modern style, from the Kindle. This is actually not Livingstone's journal, it's his book, The Missionary Travels. This is the first one he published, Missionary Travels and Researches in South Africa. Available free on Kindle for those who have that technology. Livingstone's works are there free. So what had been happening then in around this area was that the natives' cattle were being attacked by lions. And the natives come up with a brainstorm that they were going to go and kill the lions. So they got together in a big circle, perhaps a mile in circumference, and they started working in until they found lions, and then they would kill the lions that they found. So here's what Livingstone says of that fateful day. He says, I saw one of the beasts sitting on a piece of rock as before, but this time he had a little bush in front. Being about 30 yards off, I took a good aim at his body through the bush and fired both barrels into it. The man then called out, he is shot, he is shot. Others cried, he has been shot by another man too, let us go to him. I did not see anyone else shoot at him, but I saw the lion's tail erected in anger behind the bush, and turning to the people said, stop a little till I load again. When in the act of ramming down the bullets, I heard a shout. Starting and looking half around, I saw the lion just in the act of springing upon me. I was upon a little height. He caught my shoulder as he sprang, and we both came to the ground below together. Growling horribly close to my ear, he shook me as a terrier dog does a rat. The shock produced a stupor, similar to that which seems to be felt by a mouse after the first shake of the cat. It caused a sort of dreaminess in which there was no sense of pain nor feeling of terror, though quite conscious of all that was happening. It was like what patients, partially under the influence of chloroform, describe, who see all the operation but feel not the knife. This singular condition was not the result of any mental process. The shake annihilated fear and allowed no sense of horror in looking round at the beast. This peculiar state is probably produced in all animals killed by the carnivore, and if so, is a merciful provision by our benevolent Creator for lessening the pain of death. So the lion attacks him, and Livingstone says it was like being a terrier shaking a rat. But one of his trusty porters comes along and fires another two shots at the lion whilst it's on Livingstone. The lion then leaps off Livingstone, attacks the other man, ripping into his leg. Another guy comes round and tries to fire, and his gun misfires, and the lion leaps and attacks him too. The lion has all three of them for lunch. But just as it's about to devour the third man, the bullets that Livingstone fired into it take an effect, and the lion keels over and dies. Now, Livingstone's arm is absolutely destroyed in this attack. He would never recover. He sets his arm himself. Remember, he's a doctor. He has no anaesthetic. Sets his arm himself, and for the rest of his life, his arm is barely usable at all, which is even more remarkable when we think of the exploits of David Livingstone. But while he's convalescing at Kuruman, convalescing after the lion attack, he meets Mary Moffat, Robert Moffat, the missionary's daughter. And Mary looks after Robert, or looks after David. And in 1845, Livingstone marries Mary Moffat, daughter of, as I said, this man, Robert Moffat. And here's a picture of Mary. Not very flattering at all. Now, we may think this is lovely. There's Livingstone, he's become a missionary. He's met up with a missionary's daughter. They're going to get married, have lots of missionary babies, and they'll live happily ever after. What a wonderful romance. But romance had very little to do with this marriage. Livingston is not very romantic at all when he tells the missionary society about his marriage. Jill goes over the account. Livingston treated his impending marriage with a matter-of-factness that seemed to border on indifference. He could not have been more impersonal in announcing it to the directors of the society, even if he had tried. Here's part of Livingston's letter to the society, telling them about his romance and about his impending marriage. Various considerations connected with this new sphere of labour, and which to you need not be specified in detail, having led me to the conclusion that it was my duty to enter into the marriage relation. I have made the necessary arrangements for union with Mary, the eldest daughter of Mr. Moffat, in the beginning of January 1845. And if I have not deceived myself, I was in some measure guided by a desire that the divine glory might be promoted by my increased usefulness. So his marriage was to increase his usefulness, according to Livingston. He goes on, and he doesn't speak about his wife in very glowing terms at all. Writing to a friend shortly to begin a missionary career in India, Livingston advised him to choose a wife before leaving, on the grounds that the missionary he would otherwise have to lodge with would think him inferior. Livingston also suggested the best sort of woman for the job. Quote, a plain, common sense woman, not a romantic. Mine is a matter of fact lady, a little thick black haired girl, sturdy and all I want. Lovely, isn't it? Absolutely lovely. Victorian romanticism at its height. He goes on. For some other friends, he compared his wife with a mutual acquaintance, but added that Mrs. Livingston was a great deal stouter. In later life, Mary grew extremely fat, Jill says, but it is interesting that this should already have been such a feature in her early 20s. A couple of years later, Livingston was writing to the same people, asking them to send some dress material. He told them not to worry much about what they sent, and then described Mary. She is a good deal of an African in complexion, a stout, stumpy body, so you will have no difficulty in sending the proper sort of thing. This is how he described his bride-to-be. Never mind after how many years of marriage. January 1846, they have the birth of their first child, Robert. After this, the Africans called Mary just Ma Robert. That's how they described her. That was their term of endearment for her, Ma Robert. In 1847, the birth of their second child, Agnes. 1849, the birth of their third child, Thomas. And then in 1850, there's an expedition towards northwards with the family, with all these children. And then the birth of their fourth child, Elizabeth, who dies after 6 weeks. Who dies in extreme agony. Livingston says that her final screams unto him. 1851, the birth of their fifth child, William Oswell, and in 1852, Mary and the children leave for Britain. I'm just going over this quickly, of mentioning the family life. In 1858, November time, the birth of their sixth child, Anna Mary. She was born in Curriman. And then in 1859, Mary and the children return to England again. 1862, Mary Livingston goes to join David again, but dies in April of 1862. Now, Livingston's family life leaves a lot to be desired, folks. Whilst in Africa, his family would have to endure incredible hardship. And when they finally went home to the UK, Great Britain, they lived as homeless beggars, depending entirely on the mercy of others to survive. Not a nice story at all. We mustn't airbrush Livingston's faults out of history. The way he treated his family, I've said to some of the folks in the historical society, that a man in any of our congregations who treated his family the way Livingston did should be and would be disciplined by the church. Extreme hardship he put them through. Jill says this of some of the hardship. This is Livingston had it in his mind. He was dying to go and explore the north, dying to go to Lake Ngami, dying to get there. And he didn't want anyone to get there before him. This was a fault of Livingston's as well. Very ambitious. Didn't want anyone to get the credit before him. And Jill says, Livingston was prepared to take the risk. As usual, it was his family who suffered for it. Not long afterwards, they had to go 5 days without water. And as Livingston, with his unique gift of being humorous, after the event put it, quote, the less there was of water, the more thirsty the little rogues became. Now, these are all small infants at the time, small children. He did, however, concede that the possibility of the children perishing before our eyes was terrible. When they did finally reach water, it was stagnant and full of rhinoceros dung. But people with swollen lips and blackened tongues were not inclined to be fussy. As Livingston wrote with typical stoicism, no one knows the value of water till he is deprived of it. I have drunk water swarming with insects, thick with mud, and putrid with rhinoceros urine and buffalo's dung, and no stinted draughts of it either. This was constant. This just wasn't a one-off. This was the constant life of this family. And he dragged Mary and the little children around with him on that expedition. Jill also says, Livingstone thought of missionaries as members of an army with Christ as their captain or general. Sometimes he developed the argument that if soldiers died for the Queen, missionaries ought to be prepared to die for Christ. And I agree with Livingstone here. But Jill brings up a good point. The parallel was nonetheless misleading, for not even the most bellicose soldier would have thought of sending his small children into the firing line. And this is where Livingstone comes under some attack. Other missionaries and explorers could not keep pace with Livingstone either, and often felt his displeasure at their weaknesses. He was an extraordinary man, perhaps stricken down with malaria 30 times. The fever, 30 times, and kept on going. His stamina was unbelievable. But he had no time for people who didn't have his stamina. He took great displeasure in people's weaknesses. As we read from Gilles, he was such a tough character. When George, that was one of his companions, suggested that they were all going to die, Livingstone could, quote, scarcely avoid a kerfuffle at such spineless sentiments, and finally did break out laughing at George's, quote, utterly mock cadaveric face. Here was a man who thought the whole expedition was going to die. Livingstone laughs at them. And Jill goes on, this almost total inability to appreciate or sympathise with other people's physical sufferings owed a lot to Livingstone's tough and gruesome childhood in the mills. There was, however, nothing hypocritical about Livingstone's heartlessness. He would be irritated and ashamed by his own incapacity when laid low by fever. Talking about his lack of pluck and being, quote, unmanned by the disease. Yet he would force himself to keep going, even when suffering repeated, intermittent attacks. His great willpower was to save him from death many times. A man without such reserves would have given up and died. In his early days in Pituna Land, the natives had laughed at Livingstone and suggested that the heat and lack of water would soon knock him up. This, wrote Livingstone, quote, caused my Highland blood to boil and made me despise the fatigue of keeping them all at the top of their speed for days together until I heard them expressing proper opinions of my pedestrian powers. So the Africans made fun of him, saying the heat and the lack of water will kill him. And when Livingstone said that, he said his Highland blood began to rise. And he drove his porters all the harder until they gave in before he did. And until he heard them praising his, quote, pedestrian powers. Livingstone achieved many wonderful things in Africa. He mapped Lake Ngami. He discovered the Great Falls, which he named Victoria Falls. He discovered the link between mosquitoes and malaria 20 years before the scientists of the time. He discovered the healing properties of quinine, which is used to treat malaria in extreme cases. I'm not going into the entire details of his medicine he made. Here's Victoria Falls, by the way. I forgot that PowerPoint. But these were tablets that were made called Livingstone's Rousers. Not only did he map out all this stuff and do all these wonderful works in Africa and travel thousands of miles, he had the time to make a cure for malaria. And they were known as Livingstone's Rousers and used right up into the 20th century. In fact, Livingstone was one of the first people to realise the healing powers of quinine for malaria. And extreme cases of malaria today, quinine is still used. Livingstone was the man who came up with this discovery. Again, the mind of this man is unbelievable considering the things he is going through. But one of Livingstone's greatest feats was not any of these medical or geographical discoveries, but his fierce stance against the slave trade in Africa. Slavery was rife in Africa. Britain had abolished the slave trade long ago, but the practice amongst Portuguese and Arabs in Africa was as steady as ever, and it appalled Livingstone. He saw some awful sights, walking by rivers and seeing crocodiles so full with the meat of slaves that they just let dead bodies fly by. And the crocodiles had their fill. There were far too many dead slaves in the rivers for the crocodiles and the wild beasts to eat. He saw women who had been murdered just because they couldn't go on any longer and they'd be worthless to the slave trader. And Livingstone was livid about the slave trade. He writes this to the New York Herald. All I can add in my loneliness is, may heaven's richest blessing come down on everyone, American, English, or Turk, who will help to heal this open sore of the world. That's what he called slavery in Africa, the open sore of the world. And he goes on, if my discourses regarding the terrible Ujani slavery should lead to the suppression of the East Coast slave trade, I shall regard that as a greater matter by far than the discovery of all the Nile sources together. You see, Livingstone's big geographical feat was to discover, try to discover the source of the Nile, which he never did. But he says if he could destroy the slave trade, it would be far, far better and far more of an achievement than discovering the source of the Nile. Livingstone went even so far as to attack slave traders, shooting them and killing slave traders to free the slaves from their evil grip. Now, you can debate the ethics of that yourself, but this is what Livingstone did. Livingstone was a good shot. You see, he hit the lion, and he hit a few slave traders on the way as well. Seeing how far the slave traders were willing to go to make merchandise of these poor Africans was a great motivator to Livingstone. He said, cannot the love of Christ carry the missionary where the slave trade carries the trader? He says, if the slave traders can get into the middle of Africa to steal people away, why can't the missionary get into the centre of Africa? And this is one of William Carey's reasons as well, one of his arguments. If the East India Company can trade all around India and other places, why can't the missionary get in there with the gospel? In other words, if greed and evil could take men into the heart of Africa for money, surely the higher goal of the missionary should drive him further and further into unreached places. Livingstone's constant highlighting of this open sore caused the British government to send the Royal Navy to blockade East Africa and treat slave ships like pirate ships. And this act alone freed up to 150,000 slaves. The British Navy would stop these ships and free the slaves. 150,000. And in the main reason for it was Livingstone's constant harping on about the slave trade and lobbying the British Parliament. So what of Livingstone's missionary endeavours? He said the end of the geographical feat is but the beginning of the missionary enterprise. There's many today who see Livingstone as nothing but an explorer. But Livingstone said that the end of the geographical feat is but the beginning of the missionary enterprise. What were some of his methods? Well, Livingstone would go to a village. He would wait outside the village until being asked to come in by the chief. He would ingratiate himself with the chief. He would preach the gospel. He would mend their guns. He would give them a few guns to fight against the Boers and others. That's a whole different story altogether. But missionaries in Africa were seen perhaps at their best, and the best thing they could do for the tribes was to mend their guns for them. They became gunsmiths. And Livingstone would preach and he would teach everywhere he went. But what were the results of Livingstone's preaching and his missionary endeavour? Well, he's laughed at today by many because there's only really one known convert for all Livingstone's trouble. And this is Chief Shekele, Chief of the Bakweans. There was actually something on BBC, the BBC website this week, on Shekele. If you want to go on there and read it, I'm sure you'll still be able to bring it up. And they sort of make fun of the fact that Livingstone only had one convert. All this hardship, all this heartache for one single convert. So does that mean that Livingstone was a failure as a missionary? Well, perhaps if we have Charles Finney's view, remember back to the start, of revival and salvation, we could easily see Livingstone as a failure. But if we view salvation, the salvation of man, as a sovereign work of God, then no. Of course Livingstone was no failure. He was called to be faithful in preaching the gospel. And the fruitfulness of that work was in God's hands. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 6. When Livingstone realised that there wasn't, or it didn't look like there was going to be thousands of converts, it didn't put him off, but drove him to think long term, to think of those who would come after him. He reassessed his mission. He would be the one who would open up Africa for missionaries to come in behind, preach the gospel, and reap the harvest. Quote, I am immortal till my work is accomplished. And although I see few results, future missionaries will see conversions following every sermon. May they not forget the pioneers who worked in the thick gloom with few rays to cheer, except such as flow from faith in the precious promises of God's word. Unquote. And as a pastor, I gain encouragement from Livingstone's quote there. So he pressed on into the heart of Africa. The ground that Livingstone covered in his travels is mind-blowing, considering that most of it was covered on foot. while suffering from malaria and all sorts of other ailments. It's estimated that Livingstone travelled 29,000 miles in his day and opened up 1 million square miles of Africa to the cause of missions. Here's a little map here, and the red line is showing Livingstone's different travels all over Africa, crisscrossing back and forward, east to west, constantly. And here's another one for his different journeys. It's a bit like the map in the back of your Bible for Paul's journeys. And you see how far Livingstone went. And again, most of it on foot. Horses didn't do in Africa. Tsetse fly wiped them out. Most of this was done on foot. Malaria, up to 30 times. Livingstone came home twice to Britain. The first time in 1856, he came home as a hero. 1864, not so much of a hero. And one of my favourite episodes in Livingstone's life happened when he was back home in Scotland. The University of Glasgow conferred upon Livingstone the degree of Doctor of Laws, an honorary degree. And on such occasions, the recipient of the honour is usually subjected to harassment and banter at the hands of the students. Because he hadn't really worked for his degree, this was an honorary degree, the students would shout out and they would yell and they would make a bit of trouble during these sessions. But when Livingstone rises, bearing in his person the marks of his struggles and sufferings in Africa, he is received with reverential silence, it says. He is gaunt and haggard as the result of his long exposure to the tropical sun. On nearly 30 occasions, he has been laid low by the fevers that steam from the inland swamps, this report says. And these severe illnesses have left their mark. His left arm, crushed by the lion, hangs helplessly at his side. A hush falls upon the great assembly as he announces his resolve to return to the land for which he had already endured so much. But I return, he says, without misgiving and with great gladness. For would you like me to tell you what supported me through all the years of exile among people whose language I could not understand and whose attitude toward me was always uncertain and often hostile? It was this. Lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. On those words I staked everything, and they never failed. Can you see him standing there? All the young bucks are making a noise, making a mess, and this man gets up, and he's in such a state physically that the crowd deem he is fit to receive his degree. He has worked for his honorary degree, and silence falls upon him. I love the episode. Livingstone goes back to Africa, goes missing for 6 years. No one has heard Heidner Tillium. He's presumed dead by many. And then Gordon Bennett, yes, that's his name, Gordon Bennett, from the New York Herald, commissions Henry Morton Stanley to go and find Livingstone. And he finds Livingstone in the town of Ugie, on the shores of Lake Tanganyika, on the 10th of November, 1871, greeting him with the now famous words, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume," to which he responded, "Yes." Here's a picture of that meeting. Both men tip their caps. You can see his wee arm there, his wee left arm down by his side. Not long after this, Livingstone dies in the area of Chief Chittamambo's village, south of Lake Bangawela, in present-day Zambia. 1st of May 1873, from malaria and internal bleeding caused by dysentery. He took his final breaths while kneeling in prayer at his bedside. He was found kneeling beside his bed, and that's how the great man ended his days. His internal organs were removed and buried. Everyone knows that story. His heart was buried in Africa. Perhaps less romantic than everyone thinks, his body had to be embalmed for the travel. So they took out all his internal organs. It wasn't just his heart. All his internal organs were taken out by his porters and buried. And his body was wrapped up. And his faithful porters, Susi and Chuma, men he had freed from slavery many years before, carried the body of Livingstone 1,000 miles on foot. On through different villages. If these men had been caught taking a dead body through territories, these chiefs' territories, they would have been wiped out. It was very superstitious to bring a dead body into anyone's territory. But they risked their lives to take Livingstone from east to west. Risked their lives because they said a great white man should be buried with other great white men. 1,000 miles. You see, Livingstone didn't go on very well with Europeans and other missionaries. He really didn't. He was a hard man to work for, and no one could stick him, and he could stick no one else. But the Africans loved him. And this week there'll be more celebrations in Africa over David Livingstone than there will be here in the UK. So they carry his body across to the coast. He's placed on a ship, and he's taken back to England, where his body is identified by his crushed arm, and he's laid to rest in Westminster Abbey. His internal organs are buried here. There's a monument there in Zambia too, David Livingstone, and where his internal organs are buried. And here is his slab in Westminster Abbey. There's Latin there on the slab. I'm going to read from Blakely. He tells us everything that's on the slab in Westminster Abbey of Livingstone. I'd like to actually go to see the slab there in Westminster Abbey. It says, "Brought by faithful hands over land and sea, here rests David Livingstone, missionary traveller, philanthropist, born March 19th, 1813, at Blantyre, Lanarkshire. Died May the 4th, they may have actually got that date wrong on the slab, 1873, at Chimbato's village, Alalia. For 30 years his life was spent in an unwearied effort to evangelise the native races, to explore the undiscovered secrets, and abolish the desolating slave trade of Central Africa. Where with his last words he wrote, 'All I can say, and my solitude, I've already quoted this, is may heaven's richest blessing come down on everyone, American, English, Turk, who will help to heal this open sore of the world.' Along the right border of the stone are the Latin words, 'Tantus amor vere nihil est quid nosquer malim, quam faluvi cusus puris aciliu tanta lantentis.'" If you want a better translation or a better pronunciation of that, you'll have to see Morris for that. But the Latin reads like this: "So great is my love for truth that there is nothing I would rather know than the sources of the river that have lain hidden through many centuries." Of course, talking of the Nile. Then along the left border, it says, "Other sheep I have which are not of this fold. Them I also must bring, and they shall hear my voice." Other sheep I have. This is what drove Livingstone. This is what has driven countless missionaries since Livingstone. The fact that Jesus has other sheep. Not of the Scottish fold, the English fold, or the Irish fold, or even the Welsh fold, but other sheep. And this is a great incentive for missions to unreached peoples. This is the antidote to our unbelief. The cast iron certainty that Jesus has sheep, he must bring them, and they will hear his voice. This is what inspired Livingstone to endure such hardship, knowing that Jesus has other sheep, knowing that he must bring them, knowing that they will come, and believing that Jesus is with him to the end of the age. I wonder, are we inspired by that text? Are we inspired by the life of Livingstone? Inspired to go to unreached people groups? Inspired to redouble our efforts to see the gospel reach thousands of unreached people groups around the globe? I wonder, are we inspired to live self-sacrificial lives so that others who have never heard the gospel may one day hear of God's grace? Folks, if this lecture has not inspired you to go or to support missions more than you already do, then my time has been wasted. You see, we're not just here to gain knowledge about a historical figure. We must see what inspired this historical figure. We must catch his vision for the unreached peoples of the world. And 200 years after Livingstone's birth, there are still thousands of unreached people groups. Will we take up Livingstone's mantle? Will we do all we can to see the gospel spread, to see Jesus' sheep ingathered? Or will we carry on with our cosy lifestyles and worry more about what our football teams are doing than how the missionaries are doing around the world?
You actually can stop talking about your wife and children. Were they carted around Africa as well?
They were carted around Africa, and then they were brought home, where they went to school, went to finishing school. They had a better education than David himself did, as is often the case. So they were finishing school. Mary came back and died in Africa. His son Robert, his eldest son, came out to Africa to find him. When he was a young man, couldn't find him, and went actually to America and fought and died in the American Civil War on the side of the North, inspired by his father's fight against slavery. So the children had an awful time, and he had a bad relationship with all his children because of how they were treated. And when they were back in Scotland and in England, back home, as they say, they were dragged from pillar to post and left destitute and left as beggars, dependent on other people. It's not a good chapter in his life, but the children almost died on numerous occasions as young infants. He actually took the children the whole way through the Kalahari Desert. That's when they were drinking the rhinoceros dung and all the rest of it. See the Kalahari Desert. So they were dragged around the place, and as I say, it's not a good episode in his life. Yeah.
Robert, it's been said that Livingstone was more interested in commerce than Christianity and the expansion of the British Empire. And we hear a bit about that today. Do you think that's justified?
No. I believe Livingstone thought if he could bring commerce into Africa, then the slave trade would die. Because the slave trade, remember, originates from Africans. Didn't originate with Europeans. Africans sold other people or sold their own people into slavery. So Livingstone thought, if we can bring commerce to Africa, remember the Industrial Revolution is going on back home, if we can bring this commerce to Africa, then they will have no need to sell their people. And once they're civilized through commerce, then Christianity can perhaps come. I think, yes, Livingstone wanted to bring commerce, but like his geographical interests, the end of the commerce and the end of the geographical was the start of the missionary. So yes, he did think that, but it was to stop the slave trade and also to open up Africa for Christianity.
Are people in touch with any of his descendants?
I couldn't answer that. I don't know. Sorry. Perhaps somebody else could answer that. No. I'm not sure of any of his descendants at modern day.
Did he remain a Presbyterian? Or was he attached to any particular...
Well, he was a Congregationalist.
Well, I know he was. Did he remain that?
Yes. He fell out with London Missionary Society. Fell out with them for various reasons. He didn't get on with other missionaries at all. He came to Cape Town one time and he came with his family in tatters. He was black. Many people thought he was an African because he was burnt black with the sun. His clothes in absolute tatters. He was still very uncouth. Very, very thick Scottish accent. And many of the other missionaries looked down on him. And he tore strips off the other missionaries in Cape Town and places near the coast because they were living in luxury. And they should have been sacrificing more for the gospel. So he fell out with the different societies, but as far as I know, he remained a Congregationalist and a Paedo-Baptist, I think, if that's your question. He never became a Baptist, unfortunately. Though, one of the things he did carry around with him all across Africa were Spurgeon sermons, so that's a bit of a... And he went to hear, when he was back home, went to hear Spurgeon preach. Actually, a good story. I know I'm getting off on a tangent again, but this is how I do. Both Livingstone and Dr. Armitage were... They listened to Spurgeon preach one time and deliver lectures, and Armitage was giving lectures. And the three men met each other, sort of in the auditorium. And Armitage went to come to shake Spurgeon's hand, and Spurgeon insisted that he shake and greet Livingstone first, for he says, he is the worthier man. So Livingstone was a hero in his day. He was one of the most famous people of the day, and people really revered him. And he had a good association with Baptists, let's just say that, but he wasn't a Baptist himself.